Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here with us on another Sunday. Today, an interesting topic, not anything that we've discussed before. So stay tuned and stay with us. We're going to talk about artificial intelligence and the philosophy that's needed to go with it. Professor Paul Humphreys is with us. He's from UVA's Department of Philosophy, teaching philosophy of science and epistemology. He specializes in philosophy of science. He's also the co-director at UVA Center for the Study of Data and Knowledge, co-director of the Human and Machine Intelligence Group, series editor of Oxford Studies in the Philosophy of Science, published many times in the fields of his study. Professor, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, this is not... I have certainly done a few interviews where we've talked about computers or robots, but never in a philosophical sense, in the impact or the care and concerns that need to go with the growth of artificial intelligence. So to talk about the philosophy that goes with artificial intelligence to me is a fascinating conversation to have. I want to start, if you can tell me what qualifies as artificial intelligence, because it seems to me there's all sorts of different levels, I would assume.
Yes, that's correct. So, for example, everybody's car these days has many computer-controlled components which are intelligent for the functions that they have to perform. So there is a large spectrum between, you know, the things like that and the things which most people find interesting, which is at the very high level that we're coming up on in the future. And if I could just make a little bit of a historical remark. So back in the formation period of artificial intelligence, which was back in the 1950s, AI tended to be pretty specific. It was programs playing chess, playing checkers, and so forth. But the holy grail of artificial general intelligence is to try and construct a device which has the kind of enormous flexibility that human intelligence has. Humans are very good at switching from doing things like mathematical tasks to figuring out how to control a small child who's upset. And that kind of flexibility is very hard to achieve. We're not really anywhere near that yet.
And you qualify that as general artificial intelligence?
Yes, and therein lies a very important philosophical issue. Pretty much everybody focuses and bases their idea of intelligence on human intelligence, which is perfectly natural. I mean, we're in some ways the only obvious examples of artificial general intelligence. But the really interesting and, of course, somewhat dangerous aspect of future developments in artificial general intelligence is that we are probably a rather crude version of what artificial general intelligence can and will be. And it's very hard for us to imagine what those kind of devices are going to be like once they've surpassed us.
Are there... there are different terms. I mean, if a human is general intelligence, and you've already discussed the car because of its computer chip, what level is the car termed as? And if you've made mention of us being the lower grade level and something surpassing us, would that being or item be in a different classification? Does that classification as a term? And is there yet another classification that I've failed to think about?
Well, there probably will be in the future. One of the serious problems that we have in thinking about artificial intelligence is that we're probably going to have to resign ourselves at some point to recognizing that we're inferior in many ways to artificial general intelligence that's going to come around in, let's say, 50 or 100 years. And that's a really hard thing for human beings to have to deal with.
So what is the role of philosophy in all of this? I mean, because my view of it is a couple people sitting around a table saying whether that's right or wrong.
We'll certainly recognize the enhanced and superior general intelligence from the machines when we come across it. We already have some things that are clearly superior to us. But the question that you asked is a really good one, because in some ways, the philosophical discussions of artificial intelligence hit home on one of the most important things that philosophers do, and that is to consider what it is to be human. And there are many different dimensions of this. One is that we ask ourselves in epistemology how it is that we come to have knowledge in a way that a lot of animals, for example, don't. There are things in ethics, and there are definitely important ethical issues in the area of artificial intelligence. And if it turns out, as we've been discussing, that the artificial devices become more intelligent than human beings, and human beings consider intelligence to be one of the defining features of what it is to be human, for example, Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, thought that, then we're going to have to face up to some interesting questions about whether this affects our own conception of what it is to be a human.
So, Professor, not everyone listening would have taken an introductory level philosophy course. So can you give us a definition of epistemology and where it falls in with philosophy?
Yeah, epistemology is one of the three main branches of philosophy, and it concerns itself with the study of knowledge, what knowledge is and how we can come to have it. So given that intelligence is always revolving around knowledge, epistemology is an important part of the study of artificial intelligence. And now that AI has been on the scene for a while, it raises really interesting questions about whether we can gain knowledge through artificial intelligence that we could never get through our own natural resources.
In what way?
Because both in science and mathematics for a few decades now, computational enhancements of humans have taken us to know things about the natural world and about mathematics that we not only didn't, but in fact we couldn't have discovered for ourselves. So there are mathematical proofs that can be carried out by computers that are far beyond the computational abilities of human beings. And many of your listeners, I think, will probably know about the discovery of the Higgs boson a couple of years ago. And an awful lot of artificial intelligence went into identifying the kind of signals in the Large Hadron Collider that led to that discovery.
So does it take the artificial intelligence to think of the next of where to go next that a human might not think of on their own?
Good question. We're just about entering that phase where instead of artificial intelligence devices being assigned tasks by us and carrying them out, we're now starting to enter an era where an artificial intelligence device can guide, in some sense, construct and train another artificial intelligence device to carry out a task that the original artificial intelligence is not itself directly capable of doing. So it's beginning to become apparent that where we go in the direction of this society is going to be augmented by the artificial intelligence devices, and we're going to have to be pretty darn careful to control what that direction actually is.
And why do you say that?
Well, to me, when people think about artificial intelligence, you know, they naturally think in terms of science fiction movies and killer robots and so forth. but to my mind, one of the most dangerous things about artificial intelligence is its use in surveillance. Everybody now is aware that wherever you go, and I'm sorry to say that on UVA grounds and in Charlottesville in general, the number of surveillance cameras has multiplied enormously in the last few years. You are being surveilled not just by the police, but by store owners, your Ring doorbell and so forth. And much greater capacity is in the hands of governments. And authoritarian governments, and China is a prime example of this, are using it to keep control of their populations. And one thing that we as the fortunate members of a democratic society need to participate in is keeping that kind of control over the citizens out of public life in the United States.
Well, no one likes their... Well, let me back up for a second. Many people want to keep their privacy until, of course, it's needed, often after the fact. I think enough folks have seen a crime drama on television or in a movie, and the detectives go, "Do we have that on video?" Especially an overseas, a European crime drama. "Do we have, where's the CCTV?" And you can watch someone walk from sidewalk to sidewalk or street to street, in which case, that's very helpful. Great. I'm so glad they have that. Except in the United States, that's my privacy. Unless it was your town, your family member, your material, home, car, etc., that was part of that. In which case, it's, we can do this. We have the artificial intelligence. Why aren't we doing it?
Well, we are increasingly, and one thing that we have to do as responsible citizens is to keep track of developments in this area and try and balance the advantages that you've just mentioned. I mean, there's no doubt that in solving crimes, the image recognition, for example, and huge databases that you can let loose AI on can be enormously helpful. And we want those crimes to be solved. But they can, of course, be seriously misused. And so it's finding that balance between preserving the desire that we have in democratic societies for a high level of privacy with recognizing that there's a public interest in using some of these new devices that we have to come to some kind of consensus on.
Professor Paul Humphreys with us today. I've done a very poor job of highlighting our guest, Professor Paul Humphreys, UVA's Department of Philosophy, as we talk about philosophy and artificial intelligence. Professor, can computers have emotional intelligence?
It's another great question, and one that I happen to be particularly interested in. So let's try and get a grip on what emotions and emotional intelligence is. I think, you know, all of our listeners here have come across people who seem to be seriously lacking in emotional intelligence. And, you know, we try to stay away from people like that. But in essence, having some level of emotional intelligence, I think, is the ability to convey to other people that we care about them. You know, so you pick up on signals that somebody is in a certain level of distress, or they're unhappy, or they're depressed, and so forth, and you react appropriately as one human being to another. Now, part of that, and perhaps a significant part of that, is possessing empathy for other human beings. And one of the things that at the moment seems very clear is that computers can't have empathy. They're just totally lacking in any ability, and not just because we haven't built it into them, but that they're in some fundamental sense incapable of having empathy for human beings. Part of that is cultural. We grow up in a particular kind of society and interact with other human beings when we grow up, but part of it is just in the nature. I mean, computer chips don't seem to have anywhere in them a place for feeling empathy for other human beings. And if that's true, then any computational device is going to be incapable of having empathy for human beings.
But you talk about how you can tell the emotional situation of someone else by reading them. But my understanding from reading a few articles is that you can sense your coworkers, your family members, etc., emotional situation by how they're standing, a lot of times how their eyebrows are situated. I believe that their body temperature changes, something that I may not be able to read, but that a computer or an artificial intelligence could. I would think that there is artificial intelligence that could tell you, if it was programmed to have these basic understandings. It all goes back to the coding. Right. If you tell it what to look for and what it means, it would know what the output is telling you. Correct?
Yes, that's right. Now, this is going to require a little bit of a longer answer. So let me just say something briefly, and then I'll pick up again in a minute. The big issue, I think, is that at the moment, yes, there are robots that can detect whether somebody is in fact unhappy or sad, especially robots that work with elderly people.
Well, let's take a break, and we'll come back. And I want you to talk more about that, because I think emotional intelligence of artificial intelligent situation is fascinating. Paul Humphreys with us today, professor at UVA. We'll be right back. And thank you for being here with us again on Sunday morning. Philosophy and Artificial Intelligence, Professor Paul Humphreys here, UVA's Department of Philosophy. Professor, we were talking about, can computers have emotional intelligence? Can they read emotions in human beings? Can you keep going on that topic?
Sure, yeah, be glad to. So there's no doubt that we'll be able to train artificial intelligence devices to pick up on the kind of, you know, clues that human beings put out when they're in particular emotional states. But here what I think is a really interesting point. We are also, as human beings, good at picking up on con artists. That is, people who are able to mimic being empathetic to other human beings, but are faking it. And unless the con artist is really good, most of us will, you know, eventually detect that this person is not being sincere in saying, you know, that they're, you know, trying to express some sympathy for you. And I suspect that we are going to be reacting in a similar way to artificial devices. We'll say that, yes, indeed, they're behaving as if they were, you know, having sympathy for our predicament, but of course we all know that they're not, and they're just simply insincere. And unless we can get across that gap, and as I say again, I think most human beings are really good at picking up on when people are insincere, then this is going to be an area in which artificial intelligence may actually fail to interact properly with human beings.
Do you think that you talked, the way you phrased that made me think that the emotions of the artificial intelligence are completely created? Is it possible that computers can have true emotions of its own?
Yeah. Well, if by that you mean, could they have purely computer-like emotions? I suppose it's possible. But speaking as a human being, I would have no idea what those emotions are like. I mean, I will be in the same position, let's say, as someone who is autistic, and it's often thought that autistic people are unable to pick up other people's emotions. I would have no idea what emotional state a computer was in.
But if computers, and again, if artificial intelligence, if computers are designed to learn and then build on that learning and learn some more and build on that learning, and from that, can they learn an emotion so that they can then have it in their background and use it, or, you know, it become in a somewhat, I don't know if innate is the proper word here, but it becomes a learned emotion, much like a child may be born with, you know, the few basic emotions, but then they become more detailed. Can an AI learn emotions just by learning through its existence?
It could certainly learn to fake it. And probably pretty darn well. But if you know, the audience thinks about, you know, what kind of state they're in, the internal state, when they're expressing, let's call it sympathy, for somebody else whose dog has died, for example. Well, you could do that pretty well and still be thinking, well, I really don't give a darn about this dog. He was a neighborhood nuisance. And I know I have to be sympathetic to you, but actually I really don't care. And what's usually missing there is some sort of internal feeling that you would have if you were really upset that your neighbor's dog had died. And it's very hard to describe that feeling. And it's probably only by having had it yourself and knowing what it's like to really have some kind of sympathy for someone who's in a poor emotional state that you can recognize it. So it's not quite indefinable, but it's something that you really can't put into words.
Again, we are talking about philosophy and artificial intelligence. Professor, I'm curious, back to one of the very early questions in terms of the different types of artificial intelligence. Is some sort of computer chip required to qualify as AI?
No, because there's a distinct possibility that we could biologically engineer some kind of intelligence. After all, that's how we got ours, right? By a well-known procedure, two people get together and, produce something that's intelligence. And that's all done purely biologically. So it's possible that we could, perhaps in a very different way, find some way of biologically creating an intelligent entity. And it might have a very different intelligence than any existing animal or human being. So I don't think that computational devices and hardware and stuff are absolutely necessary. It's just that's the way we've been doing it for the last 70 years or so.
Well, I'm curious, when did the effects of artificial intelligence begin with unemployment? Because you go back to the Gutenberg press, the Ford assembly line, and computer chips. Where in those options does artificial intelligence kick in?
Okay, yeah. So if you don't mind, I think I would like to sort of frame this in a way that puts the invention of artificial intelligence in its own particular place. There's an analogy that was put out by a famous economist called Leontief, where he suggested that we should look at technological developments and their effects on employment in a way in which we have already seen the way that the invention of the tractor affected the population of horses on farms. As we all know, that was the standard, as it were, workhorse. And then the population of horses in the US has declined dramatically since the beginning of the 20th century. Now, that's an example of a technological innovation that radically affected some, part of the workforce, which in that case happened to be horses. So there have been a number of these kind of things. And in the case that you mentioned, the Gutenberg press made a lot of monks unemployed, at least in reproducing manuscripts. So the question for us is, what areas of employment have and will artificial intelligence start affecting the, human employment prospects? I think that's a question to ask, and it's going to do it in a rather different way than I think the couple of cases that you mentioned.
Well, let's go. Take it on.
Okay, so we have heard a lot about autonomous vehicles. It's the self-driving cars. And it's commonly projected that it's likely that once we have self-driving trucks, at least regarding interstate traffic, that is trucks that drive on things like I-81 over in the valley, that's going to put a lot of long-distance truck drivers out of work. And the numbers that you see, of course, differ because this is to a certain extent speculative. But that's a pretty clear example that if self-driving trucks actually come to be a reality, and, there's already problems with self-driving vehicles in cities, but in simpler cases, with trucks on highways, if that comes about, then truck driving as a profession is going to be severely impacted. On the other hand, artificial intelligence created a huge number of jobs in Silicon Valley. So, it's not all It's not all negative. What it means, as it usually does, is that some areas of the workforce are going to have to retrain.
In preparation for the show today, again, Professor Paul Humphreys here, Department of Philosophy at UVA, as we talk about artificial intelligence, I ran across something from a philosophist that said, sometimes you need to follow the heart and not always the logic. And at what point with philosophy and artificial intelligence do we do that, or do you believe that will ever happen?
Yeah, so you've nailed another really important issue here. And let me put it in terms of something that's called technological determinism. So there's a view that once a technology has been invented, you can't stop it. You can't put it back into the bottle. Now, there are a few counterexamples of that, but in generally, I think, you know, as you look at the history, that's true. So is that what's going to happen with artificial intelligence? That is it unstoppable? Or to put it in the way that you phrased it, are humans in general, and not just in a particular country, but in general, going to decide that we want to put serious limits on the development of artificial intelligence? Now, I think there are good reasons to think that we ought to do that. And one can, of course, go back and forth on this, and there are pros and cons of this. But there are two major problems. One is that there are radically different political systems in the world, and a number of them, of course, are famously not democratic. And the second feature is that legislation always significantly lags behind technological development, especially in artificial intelligence. I mean, if you ever watched congressional hearings on artificial intelligence, you'll see there's a sort of level of ignorance on the part of a number of Congress people, which makes it hard for them to even formulate legislation. And things are moving so quickly that it's hard for the law to keep up. So this is another really important area in which I hope that people will think through the degree to which they really want artificial intelligence entering into their own lives. As we discussed before with crime, it can be good. But in terms of invasions of privacy, it can be bad. The only certainty is that it's going to keep going because there's a lot of money in it.
I'm curious, is the world of philosophists, and I'm not sure what the academic world of philosophists would be the proper phrasing, is everyone all on the same side of thinking for this?
Well, yeah, you put two philosophers together and you're guaranteed to get a disagreement about something. So, but there is, of course, a wide spectrum of views on this. But I think in general, philosophers tend to be excited about the prospects of artificial intelligence for understanding how the human mind works, for example. But they also, I think, tend to be somewhat skeptical about the effects on society that artificial intelligence has already had. I think I'm a little more positive about the social effects. You know, when we were discussing it, I think it's clear that we've all benefited in many ways from the development of artificial intelligence. But there are these really significant dangers. And they've been exaggerated by certain people, but they're there and they're coming, and we need to decide what to do about them.
Did I just hear that artificial intelligence is overall good for the individual, but can be, you have to watch out when you give it to the community?
That's a nice way of putting it. Yes, I mean, anybody who's listening, I think, can evaluate if they think through an ordinary day at work or at home, how at least low level artificial intelligence has been, you know, a good thing. So, for example, you know, if you've got a smartphone, you usually use voice recognition. I don't type things into the virtual keypad. I just dictate them to my phone, and that's part of artificial intelligence. So it's made our lives quite a lot easier in many ways, and we all use the internet in various ways, and that's in some dimensions a really good thing. But so we shouldn't be entirely negative about artificial intelligence in the way that a few very high profile figures have been, but we need to keep in mind the negative features of not only what is here already, but what is coming down the road, and try to anticipate that and ask ourselves whether we really want, you know, what's coming to be part of our day to day home and work life.
So let's take our next break here, since I think when we're talking about philosophy, there are very few short answers. Philosophy and artificial intelligence. Our guest is Professor Paul Humphreys from Philosophy of Science and Epistemology over at UVA. We shall return quite quickly. And here we are again. Philosophy and artificial intelligence, not a phrase that I've heard together much until today. Professor Paul Humphreys shaking it up to us and letting us know how that works. Professor, we've sort of dodged around the outer edges without getting deep into it. Why are artificial intelligence ethics important? Because I feel like that last little bit about that I touched on with the singular versus a community, and you gave me some bits and pieces back. I want you to take that question on in full, please.
Okay. Well, if I can do the full thing, because obviously it's a big area, but the ethics of artificial intelligence is important for many reasons. I mean, an example that's been much discussed is the way in which machine learning, and that's another dimension of artificial intelligence, has become important in the last 10 years. So you train AI devices on very large data sets, and the machine learning algorithms let you do that. And one of the situations that's become widely recognized is that data sets are often biased in ways that we don't always understand or realize. So if you train an image recognition device, you know, so you recognize people's faces on a very large database, so you can tell males from females, the image set that you use is almost inevitably going to be biased in some way. There may be more males in it than females, or vice versa. And that kind of bias can affect the way in which the artificial intelligence devices are used. So you have to try and correct for that. And that's a really difficult job. And there's a lot of contention about the degree to which some of these biases are built into our way of viewing the world, and ways in which perhaps, you know, the data sets themselves are collected in a inappropriate way. But that's an important kind of ethical issue. That is, are the decisions that artificial intelligence devices are coming to biased in a way that we think is ethically inappropriate?
Do artificial intelligence devices, they already build and program other artificial intelligence devices, correct?
Yes, we're now in that era, yes.
Okay. are these strictly machines that keep working until a part breaks, or have we reached the stage in for any of these devices where they get tired of tasks and behaviors that people do?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, they're indefatigable. Aside from, you know, sort of electronic breakdowns, they will just go on and on and on and do whatever it is you ask them to do, or another machine asks them to do, for as long as is needed. They don't get bored in the way that human beings do, which, by the way, is one of the positive aspects of replacing humans by machines. I think a number of jobs, routine jobs in factories or whatever, are, I think, not to be disrespectful of people who work there, but those jobs are really not very interesting. And if people could be relieved from having to do them and, let's say, learn to do something that they find more to their taste, that will be a wonderful thing.
Are artificial intelligence devices solving theoretical problems more quickly than we can build for or use the answers?
Yes, they certainly can be. I mean, in science and mathematics, going back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, yes, I mean, they're so much quicker at solving certain kinds of problems than human beings are, that they're churning out vast numbers of solutions to problems in a way that we didn't used to be able to do. So it raises a question, and this is also a philosophical question: what's interesting? Right, there's a lot of science, again, with all due respect to the people who do it, is not of much interest to most people. And there are other aspects of science that are intensely interesting to taxpayers who ultimately are funding a lot of this. So I think we have to decide, out of all this output that AI devices are going to be churning out, what's the goal? Is it to better understand the world, or is it simply to get technologically better devices that can solve problems faster than we can? We're paying for it at the moment, so I think we ought to get to decide.
Again, our guest today is Professor Paul Humphreys. Professor, we were talking a moment ago about where ethics are important, but what about morals? They're not the same.
Yeah, so let me check whether we've got the same distinction here. I take morals to be an individual issue and ethics to be a broader kind of social issue. Is that the concept you're working with?
Right. So you give someone, what was the device you mentioned earlier? An iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is used with poor morals, does the government make legislation for it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a very informative answer to that. Many laws that make things a criminal offense, I think we're all agreed on, ought to be in place. Again, an issue which I hope, you know, everybody who's listening will think about is, will we be able to understand and adapt to the presence of these devices in our society in a way that we can have general consensus about what's right and what's wrong about them? So, for example, I mean, many of you, no doubt, either own or have neighbors that own Ring doorbells, the ones that have video cameras in them. For example, I have a neighbor directly opposite me whose Ring device is pointed directly at my house. I don't like this. I feel like I can't go out in my front yard without being spied upon. He's not doing it for immoral reasons, but somebody could. They could use one of these cameras to spy on one of their neighbors. That's, I think, clearly inappropriate, but the dividing line between somebody doing that deliberately and being prosecuted for it, and they simply misusing legitimately collected video footage, is a fine line. And so we're going to have to figure out what legislation we need to keep control of these devices. And it won't be easy, but we need to do it.
How close are we to dystopian AI novels being close to the truth?
Well, I mentioned surveillance earlier, and foreign governments who are already severely misusing this. I mean, most of the audience, I'm sure, has read George Orwell's 1984, which to me is one of the most greatest examples of foresight in 20th century novels. He saw very clearly how governments can keep their population under constant observation, collect vast amounts of data on their citizens, and use it to control them. That's an early example of a dystopian novel, and it's about as accurate of, let's say, a North Korean society as you could ever come. Other dystopian novels, ones, for example, that we all end up being addicted to things that just keep us happy, and we stop being smart and intelligent anymore. That can happen too, but I think with these dystopian novels, they're all really interesting, but they're all very speculative, and how we're going to end up again gets us back to this point. And this is, by the way, we talked a lot about philosophy. I would say that this is, I think, one of the main reasons why philosophy is really important. We need to think through the consequences of where we're going and collectively come to some decision about the extent to which we want to control this. I'm reasonably optimistic that at least in the West, we'll be able to do that if we act reasonably quickly before this gets out of control. But like nuclear weapons, once it's there, it's really hard to put back. So I hope everyone will think through what is going on and what's coming down the road.
So you mentioned earlier about artificial intelligence devices possibly being able to take over some of the more repetitive jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Can artificial intelligence devices qualify as an artist or a musician by doing those steps and tasks, or is there more to it that makes up artist and musician that an AI device cannot meet?
I think you're asking the wrong person here. I'm about as artistically challenged as they come. But since you asked the question, if you were played a piece of music and asked to evaluate it, is this good melody? Is it something that's likely to be popular? Is it good to dance to, or whatever? And you weren't told what had created it. You wouldn't be bringing to bear the creative process on your judgment. It was just something you liked or that you didn't. For example, there are plenty of AI generated pieces of music out there already, and there's plenty of AI-generated art. I mean, from my perspective, I see no reason why artificial devices can't do that. If, you know, they're things that have aesthetic merit or people like them, what's the difference? Why does it have to be done the traditional way with humans? It's I don't see that's necessary, but many people may disagree.
Does that mean that the artificial intelligent device that determines something that was unexpected to be found in some form of science can qualify as a scientist?
So without mentioning the word creativity, you've picked up on yet another important dimension of this. There are beginning to be signs that artificial intelligence devices can be creative. So not so long ago, an artificial intelligence device, it's a deep neural net, a particular type of them, trained by machine learning, became the world's best chess player, machine or human. It beat out all the traditional artificial intelligence programs for playing chess. It was way better than that. And one of the interesting things, and this device was called AlphaZero, one of the interesting things about this device was that it made moves in chess, and it can also play a game called Go, which is spatially based. In both of those games, it made moves that were completely unexpected from the human perspective. There were moves that a human being would not have made. Analysis showed that that was actually probably the best move that could be made at that point. I think that counts as creativity. And we're starting on down that road. And although I don't think we have genuine creativity in AI devices that operate in science right now, it's probably going to come. And that's going to be another blow to our human self-esteem, because we've always been the creators.
Again, our guest today is Professor Paul Humphreys, as we talk about philosophy and artificial intelligence, how they tie together. So, Professor, do you think that philosophists are overestimating, underestimating, right on target with the advancement of AI development?
There are some of my colleagues who definitely are, but the problem here is the speed of development of artificial intelligence and the amount of technical knowledge you need to have to really seriously evaluate how those things work. There's a lot of popular literature on these things, and, you know, it's fine as far as it goes. But it's becoming increasingly difficult for people who don't actually work, you know, full-time in artificial intelligence to really appreciate the capabilities of devices that have been developed in the last few years and will continue to be in the next 10 or 20. And I think that is going to be a major challenge in what I've tried to say over and over again here, in the rest of us keeping up and trying to figure out for ourselves the good and the bad. We don't want to just leave it to the people who work in that area.
So, Professor, we have about 2 minutes left. I'd like you to pick one of the more famous philosophists and give that person's view that you believe how that person's philosophy statements tie into today's AI.
Well, if any of the people listening want to read a little bit more, I can definitely recommend a philosopher called David Chalmers. That's C-H-A-L-M-E-R-S. M-E-R-S. He works at New York University. He's written a number of easily accessible articles. And he holds a view that there's something distinctly different about human mental abilities than you can account for in terms of neuroscience and computation. It's a view called dualism that goes at least as far back as Descartes, the 16th century French philosopher. And he's a really, really good philosopher. And I think that view, that there's something about the way that human beings think that will never be fully captured by artificial devices, is a great challenge to AI. And it's possible that he's correct about that. So I heartily recommend that you go and follow up with his work.
All right. Again, our guest today has been Professor Paul Humphreys, UVA's Department of Philosophy, Philosophy of Science, and Epistemology. We've been talking about philosophy and artificial intelligence. Professor, thank you so much. I've been fascinated for a topic that is really something that we have not covered before.
Well, thank you, Rick. I really enjoyed this, and great questions. So thanks again for inviting me.
Well, thank you so much, sir. Take care.
You too.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake-Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.